Priya bhai o bhaino, namo buddhaya, jai bhim.
Jai bhim.
So thank you very much, Ratnasagar, for the introduction. Malamarati itnahe. Ingrezi bol. Yes, I'm very pleased indeed that we've been able to celebrate Dr. Ambedkar's birthday here in this shrine room. I had so much to do with the creation of this shrine room. I was one of the leading members of the team that created the London Buddhist Centre. I was the first chairman. And so it was a very large part of my life in this room. But another very large part of my life is in India. I spend 6 months in India each year. Not almost every year, every year. Ikdom, every year. I feel very, very strongly for the work there too. So these two strands of my life, I have some chance to bring together in this particular situation so many of my friends here from India, as well as my friends from the West, under a chairman of the London Buddhist Centre who's Indian by origin, which is very significant to me. I first encountered Dr. Ambedkar when I went to India in 1985. As Ratnasagar said, Bhante asked me to go with Suvhadra and Kamala Sheela to do ordinations. He couldn't go, his mother was ill, so he asked us to go in instead of him. And I arrived in Nagpur, in Pune, on the 6th of December a park in the middle of Nagpur, of Pune, where there's a large statue of Dr. Ambedkar. What's the name of that? In near MG Road, that.
Collector Office.
Ah, yeah, yeah. And Lokamitra was giving a talk on the anniversary of Dr. Ambedkar's death. A very solemn occasion, but it's a strange sort of mixture of solemnity and rejoicing. Very strange, sort of different kind of atmosphere. Sorry, I'm talking Indian-English now. It's an atmosphere that you don't sort of really quite encounter here in the West. Just by the way, I was in Delhi on the 5th of December last year, and I went to the place where Dr. Ambedkar died on the evening, the anniversary of the evening when he died, and I experienced that atmosphere there in a very, very intense way. There's an extraordinary solemnity and a sort of sadness, but an extraordinary joy and positivity. And I encountered that on that first evening in Pune. People deeply are still feeling the loss of Dr. Ambedkar. Without him, it's unclear what the direction is. But at the same time, a sense that he's still with them, he's still alive, and his inspiration is still very much with people. So I had an immediate connection with Dr. Ambedkar through the atmosphere of people like Ratnasagar, who would have been there then. People's strong faith in Dr. Ambedkar and their sense that he'd changed their lives, he'd changed the world for them. And Lokamitra said a few things about Dr. Ambedkar that really struck me. And so I went and did some background reading and read a number of works by Dr. Ambedkar, especially Annihilation of Caste and the Buddha and the Future of His Religion. If you're interested further, well, the best thing to do is to read Sangharakshita's book, Ambedkar and Buddhism. But then these works by Dr. Ambedkar, you realise you're coming in contact with a very, very considerable mind indeed. People have such faith in him. And in India, people have faith in all sorts of charlatans and rogues, yes? All sorts of charlatans and rogues. But Dr. Ambedkar really was worthy of the faith that people had in him. A man of undoubted intellectual stature, of moral stature. For instance, in India, every politician, every leader is accused of corruption, whether they're corrupt or not. Everybody's accused of it. Nobody has once suggested that Dr. Ambedkar was corrupt. He just couldn't do it. He's so palpably honest. Even though, as I say, many honest politicians are accused of corruption, you just couldn't do it to Dr. Ambedkar. Even his worst enemies never accused him of corruption or immorality in that sense of any kind. and a deep sense of responsibility in relation to society, not just his own society, not just his own community or the community of Dalits in general, but the whole of Indian society. So towering figure. Although his grasp of Buddhism is not broad, it's extremely deep. He's seen some really important things about the Buddha Dhamma that I think are unprecedented in Buddhist history, and that to me are he's really the first modern Buddhist, the first person who addresses the modern world, not a traditional society that's sort of running out of steam. He's addressing squarely the modern situation, the modern political, social, economic situation, as a politician, in many ways very successful politician, as a statesman of world class, as a constitution writer of international stature. He's facing that world and seeing the relevance of Buddhism to it. And you've heard our friends, you've heard what Dr. Ambedkar's done for them, and it's in a way mostly quite specific. It's to do with having come from a situation of extreme marginalisation and exclusion. Most of our friends here have been lucky enough to be the second or third generation after Dr. Ambedkar and not experience the extreme of it. But it's still, in many places, terrible for people from those communities. So for them, Dr. Ambedkar is very much, first and foremost, the liberator from untouchability, to use the horrible word. But in reading Dr. Ambedkar, when I first came across him, I realised that he was speaking to me. You know, I come from a pretty privileged, middle-class, white English background, and I've hardly suffered any form of discrimination in my life at all. Fortunate to be born male as well. That's a joke. I've hardly experienced any discrimination at all. You know, just a bit of sort of, sometimes people don't like my accent. It's a bit too wah-wah. Hardly anything at all. And yet, I consider that Dr. Ambedkar was speaking to me. So I want to try to communicate why that's the case and why it's the case for you, why it's the case for us. And I've been very conscious that we're in the middle of these elections going on around us, and what I'm increasingly encountering is people's disillusionment with politics. In modern Britain, people are just fed up with politicians. So many people, when I'm saying, look, we must vote, they're saying, why? What's the point? What's the difference is it going to make? Isn't it all just to do with economic forces that are beyond our control? And I feel we really need to wake up to the fact that as practitioners of the Dhamma, we have a duty to vote. We have a duty to try to influence the society around us in a positive way. And I derive a lot of my inspiration for that from my contact with Dr. Ambedkar and from considering myself a disciple of Dr. Ambedkar. I always say in India, you know, here I am, I'm an Englishman, I've never suffered from disadvantage, but like you, I am a son of Baba Saheb. It gets a lot of applause, but I'm genuine, I'm sincere in that. So, yes, I want to try to inspire you, the very least, to put your cross with the Dhamma behind you, as it were. Let me say a little bit about why Dr. Ambedkar considered the Buddha Dhamma to be an important force for the transformation of society. He spoke very strongly about this on many occasions. In fact, on one occasion, just a few days before he died, he gave a talk on Buddhism and Karl Marx, the Buddha and Karl Marx, contrasting the Buddha and Karl Marx, and sort of respecting Karl Marx for his desire to see a just and free society, but very strongly critical of Marx's theoretical starting point, as it were, and his program. He said the essence of the difference is the Buddha's stress on reform, change in the world, coming from a change in the mind. He said, the greatest thing the Buddha has taught the world is that the world cannot be transformed, cannot be reformed, except by reform of the mind of man, humanity, the reform of the world, the mind of the world. So all change, all political and social transformation takes place because of a transformation in attitudes, in the mind. He addressed this very squarely with caste, as you heard this morning. He's saying that caste is not a thing. You can't measure caste. You can't weigh caste. You can't point to caste. It doesn't exist. It's not a barbed wire fence, he said. It's not a wall of bricks that stands between one human being and another. It's something that is created by the mind. Caste is a notion, a state of mind, he said. And he said, what mind can create, mind can undo. So for him, the essence of social and political transformation was a transformation of the human mind, of an attitude to other human beings, especially an attitude to oneself. So he considered that all political and social transformation starts with a transformation in culture and ideology. He means the way people think, let's say. And that change in culture and ideology rests upon a change in the attitudes and thoughts of individuals. So for him, a political transformation could not be merely through the ballot box. It couldn't be through the creation of a constitution. It had to be something more than that. He said famously, just a few months after the launching of the constitution in January 1950, he stood up with great despair, as Pallavi told us, at the rejection of the Hindu Code Bill, which granted equal rights and property rights to women for the first time in India. It was rejected by the Nehru government because they knew they wouldn't win the election if they stood on it. And Dr. Ambedkar completely fed up. And he said famously, and perhaps a mood of great hyperbole, who wants this constitution? I don't want it. I'd be the first to burn it. Frustration, intense frustration. Because, of course, democratic constitutions often mean the tyranny of the majority over the minority. So he said, it's as if we built a wonderful temple for some god to come and live in, and it's been occupied by shaitan, by a devil. The devil of caste, you could say. So constitution is not enough. Politics is not enough. There needs to be a deep social revolution, a revolution in people's attitudes, and that means a revolution in their understanding. He said that, for instance, the huge achievements of the Emperor Ashoka in 3rd century BC India stood upon the ideological revolution, the cultural revolution launched by the Buddha. If it hadn't been for the Buddha, Ashoka would not have been able to create even the degree of equality was possible at that time. Extraordinary society, as far as we can see, at least in aspiration. So he said that India needs a tremendous change in attitude, in the minds of people, so that they behave in a different way in relation to each other, and that they use the political constitution for good, for genuine good, and they produce a real democracy. He had a notion of democracy which was not merely constitutional. He said democracy is not a matter of the way in which we vote. It's not a matter of the means by which we choose a government. Democracy, he said, is a state of mind. It's an attitude of reverence of one citizen for another. Attitude of reverence and respect of one citizen for another. So I had an idea of social democracy as something which underlay a political democracy. India is a political democracy, but it is not a social democracy. The political constitution, which is a wonderful constitution that provides, well, quite a bit of safeguard. For instance, it meant that Amala Bodhi, the police did stop casteism from stopping him across the field, as it were. But there's so much corruption of the political system in India. The elections take place on the basis of what are known as vote banks. So an entire community will follow a leader to vote for somebody who will get benefits from it. So it's a very, very corrupt political situation system. Even the legal system is corrupt. If you know who to go to, if they're the same, if the judge is the same community as you or whatever, you may, it's not always the case, but you may be able to influence the process. If you want service from the administration, from local administration or whatever, you need to find caste fellows who will help you. So caste vitiates what is otherwise a really quite outstanding democratic project, the largest democracy in the world. But it's invaded by the lack of social democracy. I'm very aware of this in Hungary. I'm working there with some gypsies who've become inspired by Dr. Ambedkar. And what they are now being oppressed by the democratic process. So that 30% of the people in the North Hungary, where our friends are working, Dhamma Mitras of ours, working in North Hungary to create schools for gypsy children who've been excluded from schools, they are now threatened by a political party which one can only describe as fascist, so descendant of the Arrow Cross of the Second World War, which has 30% of the electorate in that area. And, you know, which has political power in a number of different areas there. So they're kind of victims. They're only 6% of the population. They're victims of a democratic system. So Dr. Ambedkar had a very clear-sighted view of politics. He knew that a constitution was a remarkable thing, and it has made huge difference to the lives of our friends here. But it's not enough. Constitution is not enough. Politics is not enough. What there really needs to be is a deep change in people's attitudes and understanding. That is our project. In a way, I've said everything that needs to be said, but I'll go on for a little bit because I'm used to talking for a long time in India, so I'll keep going. But in a way, that's the essence of the matter, that if we can let the Buddha speak in English society, in wherever anybody comes from, American society especially, Jamaican society, we can have some transformation. There will be a basis for transformation because there will be change in people's idea of themselves and of their attitudes to each other so that they see themselves as part of a single society. They experience fraternity, a sense of even love, he said, Maitri, one for another. They feel equal, just human beings together, and they allow each other to be free. So yes, what Dr. Ambedkar says, that the fundamental issue is the transformation of attitudes of the individual and of the group through the Buddha Dhamma. So I'm going to go into this a little bit further by talking about what he saw as the principal sort of targets of conversion of Buddhism, what effect Buddhism had, how it changed society. First of all, he said that Buddhism has a direct effect on those who are oppressed and excluded, the grandparents of the people here. Their grandparents, we know, lived in poverty, ignorance, and strongly oppressed. They couldn't assert themselves at all. It's a lovely story of trying to raise the flag. You can't understand just what that meant. It would have been impossible 10 years before. It had been impossible 1 year before. Suddenly people had the courage to raise their flag in the town, in the village, which just could not have happened before. They were prepared to face whatever came at them, and a lot did come at them. But because they had the courage, it didn't touch them, it didn't affect them. So becoming a Buddhist means for those who are poor and oppressed and excluded a taking on of human dignity. Because what Buddhism tells you is that you are a human being responsible for your life. You're not an untouchable, you're not a Brahmin, you're not this, you're not that, you're not white, you're not black, you're just a human being. Well, you may be white or black because that's a fact, as it were, but you're not status. You're not white or black in status, as it were, according to old systems and so forth. You're just a human being. And you're a human being who's of equal worth, equal value to other human beings. You're a human being who is capable of action. Your own actions shape your destiny. And one of the reasons why Dr. Ambedkar rejected Gandhi is because Gandhi argued that the high castes should liberate the lower castes. Dr. Ambedkar said, "No, you haven't done this for 3,000 years. Why should we wait for you now? We're going to do it ourselves. And if it's not done by us, it's not really done. We're just still your, you know, now your grateful victims, as it were, rather than your oppressed victims. It has to be us that do it." And that's what happened to our friends, parents and grandparents, grandparents especially. Illiterate people went home from the conversion with their heads high, their chests out. They went straight back to home. They threw out the gods. Amazing, you know, these gods they relied upon, they depended upon, they just ripped them down from the wall, tore them up, got precious bronze murtis, pictures of the gods, statues of the gods, pounded them, threw them in the river. Not an instant of hesitation. I've had this described to me by people who were there on that occasion. Jnanashuri, a very respected water member from Aurangabad, you know her well.
Yeah.
And she was there. She was only 12 years old. She was sitting underneath Baba Saheb on the platform in Nagpur when the conversion took place. And she described everybody walking home with such energy, such enthusiasm, just going straight back. The first thing they do, just go through the house, getting rid of the gods. And then they'd start to change their own way of life. They'd stop doing dirty and demeaning jobs. They'd dress themselves properly. They'd dress with dignity. And what they would especially do is make huge sacrifices to get their children education. Probably some of our friends here will have been recipients of that. Were like your parents, illiterate, poor, but they'd insist on you going to school. I remember Manidhamma, who some of you will know, who spent some time here. I know his father. He came on some of my retreats, and he's still illiterate, an old man. He's still illiterate. Well, he's gone now, but he was illiterate to the end. But he and his wife decided that they must get their children educated. And Manidhamma said that later in his life he realised that his parents starved themselves so that they could send their children to school. And they went without food themselves so that their children could go to school. They had such confidence in themselves because of Dr. Ambedkar and because of Buddhism. Their new Buddhist identity was an identity as a human being equal to every other human being, a human being with a moral and even spiritual destiny, something more than human, although intensely human. And this effect is tangible. I think you've had a flavour of it today. It's tangible in India, amongst the Buddhist communities, especially in Maharashtra. But outside Maharashtra, actually, you sometimes get things that are even more impressive. People from a family maybe will convert. Nobody else converts around them. And that's very, very difficult in India. It means that there's a problem of getting your children married. There's a problem of having, you know, the means of support, because the caste is social security network. And you're cutting yourself off from that. And it can be extremely difficult for people. But they do it. And they say, I'm a Buddhist. It's my duty as a Buddhist to stand up as a Buddhist, to put the Buddhist flag outside my house, to reject the things that belong to you know, the Hindu religion, and to stand up for the dignified, honest, self-reliant life of a Buddhist. So it's something real. It's something even measurable. I was very interested recently. There was a very unpleasant incident 2 or 3 years ago where a Buddhist family was murdered in a village in near Nagpur. In a very unpleasant circumstances, out of caste jealousy. Basically, they'd done well for themselves, and the other members of the caste of the community killed them very, very unpleasantly. We won't go into details. One of the most shocking things of my life, I met the brother of the woman who'd been, one of the women who'd been killed, and he had actually been hiding and seeing it happen. And so he's suffering from tremendous guilt, and just the image is just constantly in his mind. Anyway, there was a bit of discussion on it on the English language television, and which was mostly anti-caste, actually. It was quite interesting. But one of the things that was shown was the difference in the educational standards of Buddhists from other scheduled castes or Dalit communities. So you've got quite a number of different communities, is the word we use in India, who were considered untouchable, are now generally referred to as Dalit or scheduled caste. So pretty comparable. Same communities, same sort of treatment, same place in the village and so on. Often quite hostile to each other. This is what caste does. It divides and rules. This is what the British learnt when they went there. But they were, you've got a sort of control group, if you see what I mean, in scientific terms. One community converted, another didn't. The Buddhists, those who became Buddhists, by statistics of all kinds, sort of outstrip the other communities in so many ways. They've got 80% high school attendance, so it's 40% for comparable communities, and so on. Because their Buddhist identity gave them the courage to stand up and be something. The common attitude in India is, "Main kya kuru sakta hoon?" What can I do? God will help. And I've come across this so often. It's not in my power. And there's this gesture. You know, these hands are empty. Nothing I can do. I must just wait for something to be put in my hands. But a Buddhist takes his own, her own hands and does. And it happened. We've got statistical evidence. We've got visual evidence that it happens. True? Huh?
Yeah,
it's absolutely true. I've seen the same thing beginning to happen in Hungary. I mean, our work is much slower there, and we don't have the towering figure of Dr. Ambedkar, although our mitras are very impressive. But we begin to say the same things. Last time I was there, I conducted a conversion ceremony for a young man, 22-year-old man, who decided he wanted to be a Buddhist. He doesn't know a lot about it, but he knows that Buddhism means that he is responsible. And afterwards we went to Budapest, and he was just dancing through the streets saying, "I'm a Buddhist. I'm a Buddhist." And he got a new identity as a human being who was equal to everybody else, who had life in his hands, who could make something of his life. I'm hoping he's going to come here to spend some time here. You'll have a lot of fun. He can dance. I mean, it's like nothing else. I've seen it beginning to work amongst our gypsy friends in Hungary. So this is the first thing that Buddhism does for people, and I believe that it's necessary here too. It's very interesting, isn't it? What most racism is to do with a feeling of humiliation and of loss, exclusion, insecurity. It's often in Hungary the fascists are peasants and labourers who've lost their jobs or are very threatened by the change that's taken place since the end of communism. So it's a sort of response to that sort of insecurity and humiliation. You'd start looking for somebody to blame, and you resent particularly minority communities that either are doing better than you, or who you identify as the source of the problem. So there's a lot of feeling of insecurity, helplessness throughout society, and I think we'd have to be pretty cunning about it. But my own belief is that we need to address, even within British society, those people who are most helpless, or who feel themselves to be helpless, and who resort to violent and harsh perspectives in order to give themselves at least a modicum of dignity in an overall situation of humiliation. I believe that Buddhism has something to say to that sort of person, as well as to people who are their victims, to those who are excluded in other ways. There are so many situations all over the world where people are excluded and oppressed, and there's an ideology that sees them as separate, inferior. Like in Hungary, it's unbelievable. There's still, sort of genetic theories of inferiority. Most gypsy children are classified as mentally subnormal by definition. So they just go straight into separate classes, which are supposed to be special needs classes, giving them more, but actually give them less. So I think that we need to address the perpetrators as much as the victims, if you see what I mean. And I think this is an area where Dr. Ambedkar had quite a lot to say. He had quite a lot to say about other communities in India, and the poverty of the poor minds that led to such unjust behaviour. And he saw Buddhism as the solution to that problem. So it's the first thing, that Buddhism gives you dignity, it gives you a sense of personal responsibility, it gives you a sense of meaning and purpose. At whatever level, even most people taking to Buddhism in India don't meditate. They probably don't even know there is such a thing, maybe properly. They don't practice Buddhism in the sort of deeper sense that we would expect in the West. But they try to live by the precepts, and they've imbibed the idea that they are human beings. They have the future in their hands. And I think this message still needs wide promulgation in the world. So this is the first message that Dr. Ambedkar has of the purpose of Buddhism. It can transform the lives of the excluded and marginalised and poor by giving them the courage to stand up for themselves, the courage to transform their lives. This is our work. This is what Karuna Trust is funding. This is what our TBMSG is doing. It's trying to fund people who are lifting themselves up, who are taking their own lives into their own hands. There's a second area, which in some ways is more difficult to grasp, but some ways even more relevant. Dr. Ambedkar, believed in a free and just society. He was, in a sense, a liberal. He believed in democracy. He believed in the principles of liberty, equality, and fraternity, which he saw as deep moral principles, not merely as constitutional principles. So he asked the question, what makes a free and just society? And he said, it's clearly not a constitution, it's not law. Law can only deal with the recalcitrant few. And you see this in India, that law does not create a just society, because so much of society is corrupt. So the legal system itself is corrupt. You can always pay yourself out of a situation. You can always find somebody who you give chai pani, tea and water to, and that will get you out of difficulty, huh? The social structure is vitiated by the underlying lack of moral integrity. So Dr. Ambedkar said a society is really only as good as the general cultural morality. We've seen this in the wonderfully naive belief that the Americans and British had when they walked into Iraq. They thought that you give people a ballot box and you give them a Tesco's or the equivalent and they'll be free and happy. Actually, things got far, far worse for people in Iraq in the years following the British and American and other allies' invasion. It got really dreadful, so that there's virtually no law and order. At least under Saddam, there was some sort of structure of order. You see, again, in Hungary, that with the end of the communist regime, social tensions have grown. The gypsies were far better off under the communists than they are in a democratic Hungary. So it's the underlying social attitudes and the morality within society that determines its freedom and justice, not its political or legal system. It helps. It's not that it's unimportant, and it has helped a lot that India has a democratic constitution. It's helped a huge amount, but there's 90% of the change has not taken place. So 10%. So Dr. Ambedkar said, for freedom and justice, for a political and social revolution, you need a deeper cultural and moral revolution. And he said that, well, in Hinduism, you have no morality, because you have an inhuman system in which people's actions, of course there are moral Hindus, that's no doubt, but the system itself says that your actions, so to speak, are determined by your birth. What you should do and shouldn't do is determined by which caste you belong to, not your human worth. Dr. Ambedkar said that India needs morality. It needs a perspective that makes us see each other as brothers and sisters, that makes us see that we all should be free to live the life that suits us best, that we all should have at least, broadly speaking, equality of opportunity. We should start off with an equal opportunity, even if we've got very different talents and capacities. We should start broadly equal. So the question is, what is going to give that moral perspective? What is the basis for a genuine democracy? And, he's a man who'd had to work very deeply with this issue, especially through writing a constitution. And his conclusion was that mere morality is not enough. And I think this is an issue very much for us today. We're living in the remnants of a Christian moral framework, very much the remnants. It's sort of a humanism. You know, it was a great problem in the 19th century, wasn't it, when people began to discover evolution and couldn't go along with Christianity. They were fearful. What is going to keep society together? In many ways they're right. I think we're only surfing on our wealth and the remnants of a Christian morality. So what is it that morality keeps morality in being? Well, the way he put it was that mere morality is not enough. Morality must be sacred and universal. What he meant by universal was that it shouldn't be the morality of a group, as Hinduism largely is. It should be a morality that applies to all human beings everywhere. But what did he mean by sacred? This is more difficult to get at, and he didn't say a lot about it. He simply identified it with going for refuge to the Buddha. He said that Buddhism is nothing but morality. Dhamma is morality, morality is Dhamma. But it's not a mere morality, it's a sacred morality. So there are different ways of understanding this. The way I think it's best to understand it is that Buddhism, it doesn't sort of impose a morality, it distinguishes the moral character of the universe. It distinguishes the fact that the universe is fundamentally moral. We've been discussing this in our evening talks. The kamma niyama, the level of conditionality which is moral. It's not sort of constructed, it's not thought in. It's if you act in a way that Buddhists would describe as skillful, you will experience a greater degree of inner satisfaction and fulfillment. And broadly speaking, life will go better for you. So morality is structural. It's like the law of gravity. It's not that, you know, sometimes a stone goes up and sometimes a stone goes down. It's part of the way things are. So what Buddhism does, it discerns the deep moral character of the human mind and of life itself. Anywhere, on Mars, on other planets, India, China, South America, wherever you are, moral principles are the same. They're built in. There's something more to it than that, which is a bit more difficult to speak about, and which really is embodied in the figure of the Buddha, which the Buddha felt, Babasaheb felt very, very strongly for. The universe is not merely moral, it's, as it were, Buddhic. It's sort of oriented towards the Buddha. There is built into life a process that leads to the ultimate fulfillment embodied by the Buddha. What the Buddha did was open up to a current, as it were, present in life itself, structured into life, which led to his complete enlightenment, his complete freedom and fulfillment. It's not something that's sort of extra to life. It doesn't come from an external source. It's part of the nature of things. We've been talking about that as the Dhamma Niyama, the level of conditionality, the regularity that's structured into life that leads to the Buddha, and which, as it were, underlies the Kamic order, the order of morality. So what Dr. Ambedkar is saying, he was very, very proud and very important to him to say that Buddhism is scientific. He meant it in this sense. It's not making something up or adding something on. It's discerning something that's already present in life, and that the Buddha gave the clearest and fullest expression to. It's present, of course, in other religions too, but as Buddhists, as a Buddhist, I believe that it finds its clearest and least ambiguous expression in the Buddha Dhamma. You meet very good Hindus who are obviously in touch with Kamma and have some sense of a transcendental current, but they're so often caught by the system within which they practice. And you know the struggles that somebody like St. John of the Cross or St. Teresa of Avila had with the Inquisition. The system itself, as it were, defies the natural unfolding that can't help but take place with some individuals. So Dr. Ambedkar said that in the end, society requires a basis in morality. But that morality has to be a morality that's part of life, and that's deep in life, and that goes beyond us as mere individuals. A life lived just for yourself is not a moral life, it's not a happy life. A life has to be lived for service, he said. Service of society would be his Indian way of putting it. Service for others. If you don't live serving others, you cannot be happy. And the society that is based upon self is an unhappy and unjust society. Tesco's society. I'm not completely... It's not only Tesco's I'm against, by the way, but I find it the sort of emblem of all that's worst. Although goods are cheap there, I know. So, Dr. Ambedkar has a very deep vision of what a society must be. For it to be truly just, it must consist of individuals who are connected to moral principles that are embedded in life itself and who serve something that goes beyond them as individuals and which reaches out to others. He said, morality is not to do with the relations between a human being and God. He said, that is no morality. That is the morality of fear. In other words, you think, I mustn't offend God, I must do what's right, otherwise I'll not go to heaven. I mean, it's a crude version, I know, and there are versions of theism that are much closer, but that's the crude version. He said, morality, Buddhist morality, is to do with relations between one human being and another. It's about humanity. So Buddhism can never bring about a Buddhist world, as it were, by immorality. Immorality does not bring morality. But I think that very, very significant point for us to grasp hold of, that if we want a just social, a just political system and a free society, we need to be practicing ourselves moral and spiritual principles that we are also sharing with others. And this, I think, is our real political and social mission, is to spread these deep understandings of the way life works upon which a true and just society rests. That's our real work in India. A lot of people, a lot of Ambedkarites don't understand this. They think it's merely about getting power for ourselves, our turn. Our rogues in power, not their rogues. And that's what happens. They may be rogues, but they're at least our rogues. Really what needs to happen is that political and social revolution must be dependent, must rest upon moral and spiritual principles. So I've put in brief this very, very important insight of Dr. Ambedkar's, which I think is really the basis for a whole political and social vision for Buddhism today in the modern world. I'll come back to this because I want to talk a little bit about elections. But I want to mention the third aspect of Dr. Ambedkar's conversion mission, if you like. He said at the time of conversion, I'm recommending that you convert for reasons of bettering yourselves. I want you to have a better economic life, a better social life. But I myself don't need that. You know, I'm a relatively wealthy man. I've got a certain amount of prestige, a certain amount of material benefit. I'm converting for reasons spiritual, he said. So he saw his conversion, and therefore the conversion of many others, as the fulfilment of inner need, the fulfilment of an inner aspiration that a number of people, many people in society, will feel. They'll feel the need for something more than an ordinary life. They'll feel the need for something that goes deeper. He said that the purpose of society is not merely for material enjoyment. Yes, many people in India still need a much higher level of material enjoyment. And he said that, yes, happiness is very difficult without that material enjoyment. But once you've got that material enjoyment, what is life for? He said that society exists for the culture of the mind of the individual. And so he saw Buddhism in the end as about that culture of the mind. Once it's free, once it's just, once it's equal, once there's a reasonable degree of material prosperity, what it's about is cultivation, culture. Culture both in the immediate sense of a higher level of learning and aesthetic enjoyment and so on, and culture in the deeper sense of a moral and spiritual evolution. So he saw that if you don't allow space for that, those who want it will become destructive of society. I remember Sangharaksha talking about this. That he feared that in China, in the old Maoist days, that the suppression of people's individual and spiritual aspiration would threaten society. Because any energy that is suppressed bursts out, and bursts out in destructive ways. So it's very important just for the survival of security in the society that allows an outlet for those who want a higher life. But anyway, Buddhism fulfills these three purposes, he said. It gives those who are excluded and oppressed and in poverty the courage, the confidence, the dignity to, fight. Well, why not fight? Struggle. For dignity and freedom and equality. Secondly, it's the basis for freedom and justice in society in general. And thirdly, it provides those who want it and potentially everybody with the means and the understanding to go way beyond their present level of mental development, of cultural development. So, you probably could see that this is not just to do with our friends here. This is to do with us. This is to do with our society. It's to do with the world. After all, we in Britain enjoy a high degree of material prosperity to some extent at the expense of other places in the world. We're wealthy here because we exploited India for 1,500 years, 150 years, whatever it was, a long time. The wealth of Britain was to some extent built on the colonial exploitation, especially of India. So, you know, we owe something to the world at large. And there's a great deal of oppression, there's a great deal of exclusion going on. Secondly, we need to think about what can keep Britain, if we're British, what can keep Britain the reasonably decent society it is, with all its faults. It's still a really remarkable society. What can keep it decent and make it better and end whatever exclusion and oppression there is? You know, there's stuff about the Met yesterday in the paper, wasn't there? The racism in the Met, institutional racism still going on in our London police force. So what makes for a good society? What makes for a good society is a moral and cultural revolution which must be based upon deep principles found in life itself, found, we as Buddhists believe, in the Buddha Dhamma. Then finally, the Buddha Dhamma is what many, many people desperately need to hear because they want something more. They're not satisfied with a mere life of material enjoyment. They want something more. They know that life is more than that. So, you can apply all that in many, many different situations. But how are you going to apply it on May the 6th? I don't know. I really don't know myself who to vote for. But I know the principles on which I'm going to decide. I'm not going to say those now. You can log on to Free Buddhist Audio and hear my talk of last Thursday. Well, you can't. Can you yet? Yes, you can. It's just gone on. But one of the things that's really struck me is that in this area, there's a very pertinent issue. This is an area with a high Bengali population, and clearly they need to be properly represented in the political process. But most of them are Muslims. And there's something that we need to know of those we are voting for is, where do they stand in relation to the political project of Islam? How does that affect their view of us as their electors? How does that affect the decisions that they make? Islam is not a religion in the sense that, Christianity is today, although it was in the Middle Ages like that. In a way, it's not like Buddhism. It has a definite political project, which is, at least in many people's understanding, not democratic. There are those who view it in a democratic light. We need to make sure that those we're voting for are genuinely Democrats, that they have a genuine idea that there should be a secular state, not an Islamic state. As Buddhists, we have no difficulty with a secular state. Buddhism has never considered there should be a Buddhocracy, as it were. Perish the thought, judging by the way we run a lot of our institutions. But sorry, that was a cynical joke. It wouldn't work in India. there should be a clear separation. This is a very important principle in India between the state and a religious perspective. I think we should still be arguing for the disestablishment of the Church of England, although it's by and large a ceremonial thing, isn't it? But still, it should symbolically, I don't think there should be an established church in England. So, if our electors are definitely from a religious community, we need to know where they stand in relation to a democracy. We need to know where they stand in relation to a plural society. They may be fine, I don't want to prejudge them, but we need to ask. I think that's a key issue in the modern situation, which, as Buddhists, we've got a very definite angle on, a very definite position in relation to. We need to know a lot of other things about from them as well, about their attitudes to welfare and overseas development. Many, many issues we need to know about. But we shouldn't stand aside from the political process because we're disillusioned with it, as so many people are. We should look at those who we're electing, know that we have a very limited power over them, but use that moment of power as fully as we can. And I think we should be looking for opportunities to make the Buddhist perspective heard, make the perspective of karma, of morality as something embedded in reality, heard. Actually, most religions broadly coincide on what moral principles are. So, we're not kind of arguing something controversial there. But we should be sort of making sure that the moral perspective is taken into account. We should make sure even that some sort of transhuman perspective is taken into account. We should make sure that a collective dimension is taken into account. So I think it's for us to be inspired by Dr. Ambedkar to think that the Buddha Dhamma is a key to the transformation of the world. And we should be inspired by the work of our brothers and sisters in India who have made a real difference to their world. We should be inspired by Dr. Ambedkar who built into the Indian constitution moral and spiritual principles in the form of, as Dharmashalin mentioned, the principle of liberty, equality, fraternity and justice, which he understood in a very, very deep way indeed. So I hope that I've made clear how I see Dr. Ambedkar as relevant to us in trying to transform our world around us now. And I hope that we will stop the tendency that there is amongst Buddhists, actually it's amongst everybody in England today, Britain today, to sort of give up on the political process and to just sort of condemn it as corrupt and let it go on. Yes, it may be, but it's susceptible to pressure. It's susceptible to influence. Use the influence that you've got, make it change. Indians think we're daft. The elections are really, really critical. They can make a huge difference. I remember Bhante saying that his Western disciples were political babies. It's probably insulting to babies to say that. And that his Indian disciples were, politically very mature. They understood the meaning and purpose of politics. So let's be inspired by Dr. Ambedkar in so many ways and take inspiration from our Indian brothers and sisters and go out there and vote and use the time that we've got before the elections come to get to grips with our politicians and to, you've got a moment when their ears are open. They'll be shut probably as soon as they leave the place. But get them to listen for a little while and it'll have some influence. So I hope that you've got a glimpse of Dr. Ambedkar's meaning for us. And I hope that I've done justice to Babasaheb. My Indian brothers and sisters will tell me later whether I've done all right or not. Please... don't think that being a Buddhist means removing yourself from the world. Thank you.